All right, we're going to take a break from 1 Peter this morning. Not because I didn't have a message ready, but I just feel there's a passage that came up a number of times as I was talking to different people this week in totally different circumstances. So if you were one of those people to whom I brought up this passage, I'm not preaching at you, okay? But it came up a lot with a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. And I just felt led this morning to speak on this passage. It's a passage that I come back to frequently because it's something that I need to remember in my own life. And so there are things that we can take from 1 Kings chapter 19 today. And I'll probably continue to use this passage because I think it's an important example of dealing with discouragement in our lives. And the story of Elijah's life follows, it sort of divides right in half. The first half of his life is most of what we think about when we think about Elijah. I'm not sure what that was. It's the part where he goes and stands before Ahab, where he's by the brook, where he goes to Zarephath and provides the oil and the meal for the woman, raises her son when he dies, goes, presents himself to Obadiah and says, "Look, I'm ready to stand before Ahab to let him know that God's judgment is coming." He goes to Mount Carmel and faces down the 850 priests and prophets of Baal. And following that, outraces Ahab back to the city. All these amazing things that he's done. That's the first part of his life. It's basically 3.5 years of action and adventure. The second half of his life is a little bit more low-key. And it begins, just like the first half ends in chapter 18 on Mount Carmel, it begins on a mountain, but it's a different mountain for Elijah. And we get the context of the story. Again, the text is on the screen behind me. In the first 3 verses of 1 Kings chapter 19. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. Now, isn't it amazing how quickly life can change? Now, I don't think a long time elapsed between Mount Carmel and where he's going to Mount Horeb. I mean, the slaughter of the prophets of Baal in chapter 18 and their defeat there is what Ahab told Jezebel about. And then in her anger, she writes the letter to Elijah saying, "I'm going to kill you by tomorrow." So this is pretty quickly after the events on Mount Carmel. I mean, within days at least. And with Ahab and Jezebel on the back foot, we might assume that Elijah would press the advantage. He's gained this great victory for God. I mean, really, Jezebel's threat meant little with all of her religious lackeys, well, dead. She's really on the back foot. But here's Elijah discouraged. I mean, how could Jezebel do what the 850 of them couldn't do on Mount Carmel, right? But Elijah responds to this letter from Jezebel in a way that is at the same time inexplicable and totally understandable. It's inexplicable because his action in this chapter defies everything that we would expect from Elijah based on what we've known about it. This is a guy who is willing to stand up in front of the king, who's willing to stand up in front of the false prophets and the false priests. This is a guy who's willing to stare death in the face. But it's also understandable because if you've been around very long, you understand how quickly the thrill of victory can succumb to that damp blanket of despair. And the text tells us that he went all the way from Israel down to Beersheba. You couldn't get farther from where he was supposed to be. He was supposed to be in Israel, and Beersheba is the farthest place you can go. He had to leave Israel and go all the way through Judah, and Beersheba is as far south as you can go in Judah before you hit the desert. And Elijah left his servant there in Beersheba because he still wasn't done running. He had utterly given up on life itself. And as we look at the conversations that Elijah has with God here in a few moments, I think we'll understand just how deep Elijah was in the pit of despair. But no matter how far he ran from Jezebel, no matter how far he ran trying to get away from Israel and ministry, Elijah wasn't running away from God, because God was waiting at the end of Elijah's journey. You see, you can't really run away from God. Now, let's jump back into the text here as we consider the attitude that he has as he leaves Beersheba in verses 4 to 8. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord. Take away my life, for I'm no better than my father's." And he lay down and slept under the broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, "Arise and eat." And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, "Arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you." And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the Mount of God. So Elijah travels alone for a day after leaving his servant in Beersheba, and exhausted after a day in the desert, he arrives at the broom tree and he requests death from God. And so what hundreds of prophets of Baal couldn't do on Mount Carmel, bring about his death, all of a sudden he's begging God to do. Elijah was requesting from God, "Just take my life." I once heard an interview with the golfer with the awesome name, Rocco Mediate. He's not one of the top golfers in the world. I don't think he's ever broken into the top 200 golfers in the world. But he's known for one thing. In 2008 at the US Open, he came out of nowhere and through four rounds of golf, played even with Tiger Woods, who was number one in the world at the time. And they went into a playoff on Monday, in which Rocco Mediate ended up losing. But this guy came out of nowhere to challenge the best in the world. And I heard an interview with him after that, asking him about it, and they said, "Tiger Woods is so, one of the things that he does is, you know, on the last day of a tournament, he's so in the zone," at this time, it's not really true anymore, but he would just get in players' heads and psych them out. And he's like, "Did you feel that when you were out there with Tiger on that last day?" And Rocco Mediate said, "You know what? No. There's nobody on that golf course who can get into my head except me. And so if somebody psychs me out, it's me getting into my head and not somebody else." And I think that reveals the truth about a lot of us. A lot of times, we let ourselves get into our heads and find ourselves, like Elijah, in a place where we wouldn't be all the time because of what other people have done, but we allow ourselves to get into a place of discouragement. And so as we analyze just for a few minutes this funk that Elijah was in, I want to think about the reasons for discouragement that are exemplified by Elijah here. It started for Elijah with external attacks. All right? And for him, it was in the form of a letter, but it isn't always. Sometimes it can be verbal, sometimes it's physical, sometimes it's financial, sometimes it's relational. But external attacks arrive in our lives, like for Elijah, quickly and without warning. And a lot of times they take us off guard. And they, believe me, attacks from the outside don't always correlate with the purity of our motives. Because sometimes good deeds don't go unpunished. I mean, Elijah was serving God. This came out of nowhere. I remember for me, I was fresh out of Bible college, and I was asked to do an adult class for a few weeks when the teacher was gone, and I went in, and taught on the story of Jonah for 3 weeks. And there was an older woman in the class who just took something that I said in there, just in passing. It wasn't even in my notes. I had just said it in passing. And she seized on that and wrote me this like pages long letter about how I was so wrong and all this kind of stuff. And I mean, it really got into my head. I was so down. Now, I'll admit, I'm prone to discouragement anyway. But I never wanted to get up and speak in front of people ever again. And I was so discouraged. It took me months to be confident enough to stand in front of people and preach again. Or teach or anything. But thankfully, through the counsel of an older friend and just, you know, getting over it, that drove me to study deeper and to work harder and hopefully, I think, I've become a better public speaker because of that incident early on in my life. But man, it hurt at the time when that letter showed up and I was like, man, they just asked me to speak. I'm not trying to do anything special here. But it gets you discouraged. And we could examine just about any Bible hero and find times of external attacks because they're common to all of us. I mean, think of the ways Joseph suffered. Think of Daniel. Time and time again, it doesn't matter who was in charge. It starts with Nebuchadnezzar a few times, and then Belshazzar takes over, and then Darius comes on. And it's just, it doesn't matter who's in charge. He's always facing attacks from the outside. I mean, listen to what Paul said over in 1 Corinthians 11. He said, I've suffered far greater labors, far more imprisonments, with countless beatings, often near death. 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews 40 lashes, less one. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 I was shipwrecked. 1 night and 1 day I was adrift at sea, on frequent journeys, in danger of rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, in toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. That's Paul's ministry. External attacks are going to come. And oftentimes they can take us off guard and get us down. And that led, not just starting with the external attacks, it led to a place for Elijah, and also getting him down, was this spiritual and physical depletion. See, for over 3 years, Elijah had been standing toe-to-toe with the false prophets, with the bad king, with all sorts of evil in his country. And all of this was attacking his faith. And eventually, taking those stands will take their toll. And when you find yourself spending time pouring yourself out, eventually, because we're human, we find ourselves empty because we've just been poured out completely. I mean, when you go out and work a hard physical job, you come home tired and you expect that, right? But sometimes, I was talking to somebody this week, I can't remember who it was, about the fact that sometimes, you know, it's exhausting to sit in a hospital. There is just something about sitting in a hospital that is exhausting. I remember when Michelle would be up in Tala and I'd go sit up there and I'd get home at night and just be ready to drop. And they, all they did was sit in the stupid hospital room all day long. How am I so exhausted? But this spiritual and mental depletion can sneak up on you, especially if you're not physically tired from doing physical things. And even when we see it happening sometimes, we tend to just let it go because, I shouldn't be feeling this way. I shouldn't be tired. I shouldn't be spent. I should just keep going. And it can come, again, from a variety of things. As I say, time in the hospital, taking care of a sick or dying loved one. Sometimes it's bouts of insomnia. I have a friend who struggles with this to this day, as far as I know, where he'll go night after night and not be able to sleep at all for no reason. And he's a pastor. And it just wears him out. Sometimes it's the support of a friend or a loved one who's going through hard times. Sometimes it's pressures of deadlines at work. All of these things, they're not physical, but they can deplete us. And if we're not careful, in those times, we're vulnerable to the attacks and vulnerable to discouragement. And it led Elijah to a place where his emotions turned inward. Listen to his complaint. Oh Lord, take my life, because I'm no different than my dead ancestors. And that's the sort of self-centered nearsightedness. He couldn't see anything beyond the tip of his own nose. And it's both a cause and an effect of his discouragement. It goes hand in glove with spiritual depletion, because after pouring himself out for others, after pouring himself out for God, he had just had enough. And he was spent. And I'm not trying to justify Elijah here. I'm just trying to analyze and compare how this episode in Elijah's life parallels our own experiences often. And let's just summarize this with a look at the discouraged mentality that we can get to when we come, like Elijah, to Mount Horeb. There's a loss of perspective here for him. A loss of perspective. And I see a parallel here with Elijah and Peter. That story of Peter, when he comes out of the boat, takes that giant step of faith. He's got his eyes on the prize. He's following Christ. He's walking on water. The storm is raging. Don't forget, the storm hasn't been calmed. But he's walking on the water. But when he gets his eyes off of Christ, onto the storm, onto his situation, onto himself, that's where he starts to sink. And that's what happens to us so many times. We just let our gaze slip a little bit from where it needs to be, and all of a sudden, like that, we're sinking. And then there's an abandonment of spiritual ministry. I mean, that's what he did when he was at Beersheba and left his servant there and went into the desert. He was saying, God, I've had enough. I don't want to serve anymore. And when we get down, especially if the depression, the discouragement is coming from the outside, sometimes it's tempting to just throw your hands up and say, God, I've had enough. I don't want to serve you anymore. And then for Elijah, it also manifested, and this is where we need to be careful, and a desire for death. I mean, you think about watch the progression of the discussion of Elijah's life through this passage. In verse 2, Jezebel desires to take his life. And Elijah says, I got to get out of here. I'm going to run for my life. A couple days later, he shows up in Beersheba, goes a day out into the desert, and all of a sudden he's saying, you know what, I ran for my life, but now I'm just ready to give it up. And then later on, it comes back around to twice in verses 10 and 14. He complains, my enemies want to take my life. You know what? What confusion. But that's sort of where you get when you get to this point of discouragement and despair. But if we aren't careful, if we don't guard our hearts and our minds in these times, those thoughts of despair, discouragement, depression can find outlets sometimes even for believers. Listen, in thoughts of suicide. And that's something we don't like to think about. We don't like to talk about. But I think it's something we need to be honest about. Believers struggle with this as well. And I'll give you two personal examples from when I was in Bible college. There was a guy in my dorm studying to be a preacher who got into some financial trouble. The school asked him to take a break until he could get his life in order. He went home and took his own life. In the same dorm, a close friend of mine, whose dad was a pastor, got a phone call one day that his dad had taken his own life in the office in the church. It's serious. We need to guard our hearts and guard our minds. That's where Elijah got to, because he was so discouraged, was in serving God. And listen, those thoughts don't come from God. I don't know where you're coming from. Maybe you're sitting there going, what? I don't know what you're talking about, but maybe somebody is. God is life. God is living. He is life-giving. And he is life-exalting. And so if you struggle with discouragement, depression, and it manifests itself in these type of thoughts, it doesn't come from God. And there's no sense lying to yourself about it or trying to hide it. If you have problems, look, come talk to me. We can work through this. But let's be honest, that for some people, this is where discouragement can get them, even as Christians. But it's not where God wants us to be. And through all of this, this scene under the broom tree reminds us of God's compassion and His provision. Because even when Elijah is saying some pretty stupid stuff, God's right there. The angel shows up, provides him with something to eat, something to drink, refreshment. And this spiritually, physically, emotionally wasted prophet collapsed beside the tree, finds provision from God, finds rest before God brings him to the point of accountability. And contrary to preaching that I've heard on this passage, God has not given up on Elijah. And if you go on, as I said, this is just the beginning of the second half of Elijah's life. Elijah still has a lot of ministry ahead of him. God hadn't given up on Elijah, even though Elijah was ready to give up on God. But God brings him to a place, beginning in verse 9 there, of detachment, getting him all alone with God. He came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him. And he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away." And he said, "Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord." And behold, the Lord passed by. And a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left. And they seek my life to take it away." Elijah finds himself on Mount Horeb, which is the ancient name for Mount Sinai. And the Hebrews traveled from Sinai to the Promised Land over the space of 40 years. Elijah takes 40 days to get back there. It should have only been a matter of 2 weeks, but either way, the entire journey speaks of Elijah walking away from God, walking away from God's call in his life. But God walked with him even as he walked away from Israel. God met him in the desert, and God waited for him at the journey's end. Elijah wanted to get away from God, wanted to get away from the call of God on his life, and yet God met him in every turn. Because that's the grace, the mercy, and the love of God. And God lets him get to a place of absolute solitude. It's not the first time Elijah was alone with God. He spent months, possibly years, alone by the brook early on in his ministry. Here he's alone with God for an entirely different reason. But there's a point to be made that sometimes getting alone with God during times of discouragement or disappointment is a good thing. What does Psalm 46:10 say? "Be still and know that I am God." And you'll find that a lot. Elijah's not the only servant of God that spent time alone in the wilderness. It's a common place for God's servants to be, to get alone and to let God minister to you. And we have a hard time living Psalm 46:10 sometimes, especially in our busy world, of finding the space to stop and listen. even to stop trying to serve and pour ourselves out all the time, but just to stop and listen to God. Knowing God, communicating with Him, takes deliberate time apart. And Elijah might have been at a low point in his spiritual life when he reached the mountain, but at least he was able to get alone with God. And that the part that we read, it's interesting, because twice, separated by God's appearance, we basically have the same conversation. They start with that question, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And the first time God asks it, Elijah tries to get God to come over to his side, tries to get God to see his point. And he pours out all of his frustrations to God. At least he took it to the right person. It's the same thing that he did if you go back to the upper room when the widow's son dies and she's angrily saying, "Why did your God save our lives with the meal and the oil, and now why has God let my son die? I don't understand." You know what? Elijah didn't understand either. But he just picked up the dead boy, carried him upstairs, places him on the bed, and closes the door. I love the way that that story plays out there. And after the door is closed, Elijah turns around and goes, "God, what are you doing?" And as I've said before, I don't think God minds the fact that sometimes we pour our anger and frustration out on Him. Job did that. God's big enough to handle it. The one thing, I love the quote from Philip Yancey, the one thing that God can't handle is our silence. And so Elijah, at least in his bad place, at least he turns to the one place that he should have turned, to God, and pours out his frustration to Him. Do you think God missed what had happened to Elijah? Do you think God underestimated the power of Jezebel? Do you think that God was incapable of saving Elijah even if Jezebel came for his life? Throughout all of this, God was still in control. But Elijah overreacted, just like many of us overreact sometimes. Whether we say it aloud or not, sometimes we suggest or think that perhaps God has lost the plot somewhere along the line. But God did not answer Elijah's complaint, just like He didn't answer Job's complaint. He simply told the prophet, "Go outside and watch." An intense wind, earthquake, and these fiery blasts buffet the mountainside. And the way the text describes it, God says, "Go outside and look." And then the next time God comes along, Elijah has to come back out of the cave. It's like Elijah was just awed back into the back of the cave by this amazing display of power. And Elijah knew the power of God. This is Elijah who called down the fire on Mount Carmel. That's already happened. He knows that God can work in powerful demonstrations. And I think these manifestations reminded Elijah, like Job before him, that God is in absolute control of everything. And sometimes we just need a reminder of how powerful God is. But that's not how God drew Elijah out of the cave. Because after God sends this elemental barrage against the side of the mountain, the text says that God didn't come to the prophet like that. When the wind stopped howling, when the ground stopped shaking, when the fire stopped burning, all that remained was a gentle, calm breeze. And sometimes we imagine God only in the shouting, only in doing things that are big and loud, but Elijah found God in that gentle, calm breeze. And in the stillness of that moment, God drew Elijah out of the cave and repeated the question, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Now, the rest of the story is another message. God has a commission for him to get back, to get active. God never really responds to Elijah's moaning in this passage. He had a plan for Elijah to get up, get back to work after a time of quiet, a time to get his thoughts back in order. And God wasn't done with Elijah. Sometimes we need that time alone to reorient our perspectives, but then it's time to get back to serving God. And this second mountaintop experience in Elijah's life, I love it, because I'll be honest, I see myself right in this passage. Because whether you see it or not, I get down. I get discouraged sometimes. Michelle can tell you. Please don't. But the truth is that we regularly need to be reminded of the truth of this passage. That when our emotions are out of control, God is not. When we feel drained, God won't be emptied. Jeremiah learned this truth. After he watched his beloved city, Jerusalem, sacked, plundered, and burned by the Babylonians, he wrote the book of Lamentations. And right in the middle of that funeral dirge for Jerusalem, he centered his emotions on the character of God. In Lamentations 3, 22-26, amazing passage. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore, I will hope in Him. The Lord is good to those who wait for Him, to the soul who seeks Him. And it is good to one who wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. God is faithful. God is in control. Life can change. And the demonstration of power on Mount Carmel yields to depression on Mount Horeb in the blink of an eye. But God doesn't change. He is the God of steadfast love. And He is the center in the storms of life. Father, I thank You that You're a loving God. I thank You for Your steadfast love that meets us in our discouragement, that lifts us when we're sinking in the storm. Thank You that You love us so much that You remember that we are but dust. Thank You that You don't give up on us even when we're tempted to give up on You sometimes. I thank You, God, for Your steadfast love. Love that was demonstrated in the cross of Calvary, where Christ became our sacrifice and brought us back into fellowship with You. The one who walked on the water to Peter and who lifts us when we're sinking. And in whose name we pray. Amen.